Dan Quayle and Murphy Brown seem like a rather unlikely combination to capture the attention of the entire nation in this most unusual election year. And in case you haven't heard the story or don't know what's going on, Murphy Brown is the fictional character, the star in the third highest rating network television show. She's beautiful. She is the successful anchorwoman of a television news program in the story. She is single. She became pregnant. And in an episode about a month ago, bore a son. The Vice President of the United States of America made really what was a passing remark in an 8.5-page speech that was related to the Los Angeles riots, in which he said the following words: "The failure of our families is hurting America deeply. Children need love and discipline. They need mothers and fathers. A welfare check is not a husband. The state is not a father. Bearing babies irresponsibly is wrong. It doesn't help matters when primetime TV has Murphy Brown, a character who supposedly epitomizes today's intelligent, highly paid professional woman, mocking the importance of fathers by bearing a child alone and calling it just another lifestyle choice." If you follow the news, you know that those comments have ricocheted through just about every political group and every political issue of 1992, from abortion to feminism to traditional family values. And if nothing else, it is amazing that this has made fatherhood controversial on Father's Day in 1992. It is at a time when the country and the culture are changing, when the social fabric of America is tearing. A time when last year, in 1991, there were 1.1 million babies born to single women out of approximately 4 million live births in the United States. A time when many fathers have failed to take responsibility for the children that are theirs, even those under court order to pay child support often pay nothing or disappear in order not to pay that which they have been ordered to pay. And we begin to wonder in all this, where are the models? The models, especially now, for fatherhood. The way I see the world and what's happening in 1992, it's tough to live. It's tough to be anybody. It's tough to be a woman, or it's tough to be a man. It's tough to be a mother. It's tough to be a father. There are many men who today are entering fatherhood frightened. Frightened because they have no model. They never knew their own father. And so no example of how you're supposed to do it. No reflection or memory of the way it was when I was a boy. And then there are those who knew their fathers and wish they didn't. Their fathers were such negative examples that in their own exercise of fatherhood, the best they are able to pull off is try to do it in a way that is different from that which they experience. So where does a father look for an example? Where do you find a father who did it right? Well, in the Bible. There's a story there of a conversation between a father with faith and Jesus Christ himself. Look at it with me. It's in Matthew 9:18 and following, starting on page 1509, there in the right-hand corner of that page in your pew Bible. It is a story that is filled with faith and with fear, the mixture of grief and of joy. It explains that while Jesus was saying the things recorded earlier in Matthew 9, a ruler came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." Jesus got up and went with him, and so did his disciples. Just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I will be healed." Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter," he said. "Your faith has healed you." And the woman was healed from that moment. When Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, "Go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. News of this spread through all that region. The first lines of this story are loaded, just loaded with meaning and with emotion. This man who interrupted Jesus when he was teaching was a most unlikely candidate to do what he did. He is described as a ruler, but we should understand that what is meant here is not a political ruler. He was not a king or a prince or a governor, but he was a ruler of the synagogue. That is, that religious gathering of Jews. He was the top person, an elected post. He was in charge of basically everything that went along. The selection of the reading of scripture, who would do it, who could speak, who could not, how the rules were established, and then policing the keeping of those rules. In those days, to be a ruler of the synagogue meant that you were a Pharisee. Pharisees were the legalists. They were the right wing, the fundamentalists of Judaism in the first century. And by and large, they were enemies of Jesus Christ because they perceived him to be a heretic. They thought that he was not from God, but that he was empowered by Satan. And so, throughout the New Testament, it was the Pharisees who came to Jesus, who argued with him, who asked him leading questions, who plotted against him in order to have him killed or arrested and to have others kill him. It must have been a very difficult thing for a man who was part of this group of Pharisees, for someone who was prominent enough to be a leader of the synagogue, to come to Jesus and to ask him for help, except this guy was desperate. My guess is that he had tried everybody else. He had been to the physicians, he had been to the religious people, he had prayed, he had done everything he knew to do without success. And so he was going to go to Jesus, regardless of what his fellow Pharisees would think. All because he was a father. A father who loved his daughter. A father who was desperate to do anything that might save his daughter's life. And so he saw himself not as someone with a religious label or someone who held some prestigious position. He was simply a desperate dad who would do anything in order to save the child he loved. We sometimes forget what are the primary relationships of life. Too often defining ourselves in terms of our job or where we live or the car that we drive or the clothes that we wear or some external description or characteristic. When I think of my own experience growing up, I was the son of a pastor, my father pastoring the same church for nearly 35 years. So he was the pastor there long before I was born and many years after I was married and moved away. And it was a question that I was often asked as a child, even to this day, sometimes asked by people that I've never really had a good answer for. People would say, "What is it like to be a pastor's son?" And I just didn't know what to say because I never thought of it that way. It was never discussed that way in our home. I didn't think of him as a pastor. I thought of him as my father. That was simply all there was to it. And so that daughter who was sick saw her father as her dad. He saw himself not by the labels that everyone else would typically put upon him, but simply as a man who was desperate for the health of his daughter. He came to Jesus in his desperation, and our Bibles say that he knelt when he came to Jesus. But actually, the word that's used means far more than that. It is the word that the Greeks would use when someone would actually lie down prostrate before someone else and kiss that person's feet. It's a word that is sometimes translated into English as worship. Can you imagine that man doing that? Coming to Jesus, perceived by many of his best friends to be an enemy, and just humbly lying down before him and pleading for his daughter's life, I got to thinking about this. And I got to thinking about what we would do. And I came up with what you may think is a rather bizarre exercise. I got to wondering how many fathers would be here on Father's Day morning and what the response would be if I were to suggest that all fathers who really are concerned about the lives and the spiritual welfare of their children, whether infants or their children who are now adults, would come up as part of this service and lie down flat on your face on this platform or on the carpet around the front or in the aisles and pray out loud, pleading with Jesus Christ for the best or for the need on behalf of your child. I wonder what the response would be. And I know some of us would say, wow, I wore my good suit today. If you told me, if you had told me this was going to happen, I would have worn the old suit, but I don't want to get things wrinkled or dirty. Or I got to think about what my response would be. My response would probably have something to do with everybody else's response. Maybe if everybody else did it, I would do it, but I certainly wouldn't want to be the only one who would do it, because what would people think? And they'd think I'm kind of wacko, kind of weird, really, some kind of religious fanatic to do that for everybody else to see. And that would be hard, wouldn't it? What do you think the response would be? I don't think it would be many. But this man did it. He didn't care what it did to his clothes, and he didn't care what it did to his reputation. He didn't care what anybody thought or said. He came to Jesus, lay down on the ground before him, because he was desperate and willing to do anything for his daughter. His faith was stunning. He said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." Did you know that up to this point in the New Testament, there is no record of Jesus ever raising the dead? This man did not come and ask Jesus to do this on the basis of history. It isn't because he had heard that Jesus had done this for someone else's daughter or son. It had never been done by Jesus before, as far as he knew. But he had a basic understanding of who Jesus was and the power that he had and the kinds of things that he might do. And on the basis of that, he exercised this kind of faith, asking Jesus to actually raise the dead. Now that's the kind of father to be this Father's Day. Desperate enough to do anything for the good of your son or daughter, with enough faith in Jesus Christ that he will intervene and even do things that you've never known him to do before but are consistent with who he is. And then I'm intrigued by Jesus' response. Jesus got up and went with him. There were crowds of people around. He was teaching them. They had come from a great distance. What he was saying was important. This was a significant thing that he was about before this father ever showed up. But in order to accommodate a father who believed in him, in order to meet a need in that family, for that girl, Jesus just stopped what he was doing and took that first step toward that man's house. No grudges. Wouldn't you think that Jesus would say, "Look, you're part of the Pharisees, and you guys have been causing me nothing but trouble. Now see what happens? And now you suffer the consequences of everything that you people have said and done." None of that at all. Jesus just sets it all behind and goes with it. There's some who may want to argue and say, "Hey, this guy had weak motive. Weak faith in the sense that he really wasn't pure in that which he was about. He wasn't doing it for God. He wasn't doing it for the ministry or the reputation of Jesus. He was doing it because of what he wanted, because he had a need, because he was hurting." But Jesus never criticizes him for any of that. Even if it becomes for reasons less than the best, Jesus is satisfied just that he came. Just that he believed. I try to imagine the emotions of that father as he, there lying on the ground, senses that Jesus is taking the first step in the direction of his home. And those feelings of desperation must have just disappeared. And his emotions must have just soared with hope that maybe, just maybe, no, it was going to be. Jesus was going to come and his dead daughter would come back to life again. And then just as his emotions were soaring to these heights, they came crashing down again. As the man was surprised by the behavior of a stranger whom he had never met before, who precipitated a totally unexpected delay. It came from a woman who for 12 years had had a menstrual flow that could not be cured, who had worked her way through the crowd. You know, in a crowd, people are bumping into you and people are hitting into you. And yet she just touched him. As someone has cleverly said, many thronged him. One touched him. In faith, she reached out believing if she could just touch a thread of Jesus' clothes, she'd be cured. And Jesus, with all the bumps and all the crowd, sensed her delicate touch. There was something different about it. And he turned to her and said, "Your faith has made you well." It was impressive. Impressive what happened. It was a stunning thing again that Jesus had demonstrated his power for everyone to see. His reputation. His reputation was greatly enhanced. It was one of those events that it's like a Roman candle going off, the greatest burst of all at a 4th of July display on a dark night. She was thrilled. The crowd was thrilled. Her family was thrilled. The disciples, everyone was ecstatic. Except for that father. For what caused everyone else to celebrate, for him, must have been a terrible, terrible delay. You think to yourself for a moment, if your child were desperately ill, you called 911, it seemed like forever until the ambulance arrived. They quickly placed your child in the back and with sirens screeching went through the streets to the hospital, radioed ahead to have all of the medical personnel there with the equipment that was necessary, knowing that every second counted. Only to have the ambulance driver hit the brakes, shut off the siren, pull over to the side and have all the attendants get out and help someone who'd been sick for 12 years. Wouldn't you say she can wait? In 12 years, one more day? What difference does that make one way or the other? Couldn't she just come along and later? I mean, hardly a matter of priority here that she be helped when his daughter, this was a death and life crisis. That day, that father learned a lesson that many fathers are still learning today. It is that Jesus' compassion for someone we love does not mean that he is less compassionate for someone we don't even know. The lesson that it is God himself who sets the priorities. There is a sense in which Jesus is the triage officer of the crises of the world, and it is he who determines where his powers and presence will be deployed and in what order and in what way. You see, fathers of faith often must wait. And sometimes the hours seem like days, and the days seem like years, and the years as if they are eternity itself. Understand that by loving and helping another, Jesus has not forgotten. He has not forsaken you, nor yours, and your need. And so fathers like this father of Matthew 9, keep the faith. Like this desperate father, wait for Jesus. because he has not forgotten. At last they arrived at this man's house, to the place where his daughter had died. The scene was full of noise and people and grief. You know, in different cultures, people grieve in different ways. And we have all of our customs with caskets and cemeteries and visitation and all of the procedures that are part of our way in America at the end of the 20th century of dealing with the difficulties of death. And so they had theirs, and ours would perhaps seem strange to them, and theirs, I'm sure, seems strange to us. For example, one of the ways that they would express love and devotion for those that have died is that they would hire professional mourners. Now, that seems inappropriate to us, but to them it was the way it was done. They would hire them, and the more money you had and the more you cared about the person who had died, the more you would hire. The professional mourners were women. They would come and they would cry, they would wail, they would lament. They even would keep track of other people in the community, including you, with a memory of when you lost someone, so that they could try to resurrect your grief. It sort of tack on to it. And when you would arrive to visit the family, there they would be crying, and they would immediately mention the name of the person for whom you had been grieving that died 6 weeks or 6 months or even 6 years earlier, so that you'd try to bring their emotions into it, and they would lament and weep and wail. Grief is a strange thing, the way it comes back, sometimes unexpected and uncontrolled. This past week, Charlene and I were in Dallas, and as tourists, we went to the place where John Kennedy was shot. We went up to the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository. We stood by the place where Lee Harvey Oswald fired the rifle. We went through the museum, and there are TV cameras and there are TV screens that report the events from 1963. There are the newspapers up on the wall, all the artifacts. And, you know, it really touched me. I stood there in front of one of those TV monitors and watched and listened again as Walter Cronkite announced to the nation that President John Kennedy has died. And when he said it, the tears just filled up in my eyes, and my throat started to choke up. It was all the emotions that I remember from that November day in 1963. They just all came back again. I have seen that picture. I have seen that Lincoln Continental. I've seen all that thing hundreds and hundreds of times. When I was reminded, the emotions of grief all came back again. That's what these professional mourners would do. And then they would hire flute players who would play the music that in those days was most associated with death. You know, music often can touch an emotion inside of us that words and other memories can never do. It just somehow can reach inside our soul and almost pull a string that has a flood of emotions attached to it. And so there are the mourners, and there are the flute players, and there is the grief all being expressed, the tremendous emotion flowing and flowing. And then Jesus spoke. He told them to all get out. And he said words that must have seemed strange indeed. "Go away," he said. "The girl is not dead, but asleep." And the flute stopped, and the crying ended, and they laughed. They roared in laughter at the stupidity of Jesus. It was obvious that she was dead. And I think to myself, their grief couldn't have been too great to so quickly and easily traded in for laughter. But the Father didn't laugh. I can't imagine him laughing. For when Jesus spoke the words of life, while they must have been confusing to a father who was convinced that his daughter was dead, nevertheless, it gave to him hope. And then after the crowd was expelled, Jesus entered the girl's room, and he reached out and he touched her, and he took her hand, and she got up. And the crowd that had been so noisy was dumbstruck with silence, with awe at what Jesus could do. And the Father, I don't even want to attempt to say what he felt. The happiness and the joy beyond description. And the news spread like a soaking rainstorm across the region until it touched everyone. Everyone heard about the girl who was alive, about the Jesus who made her alive, and about the Father, about the man who knew how to be a father. I read this story, and there's a lingering question to it. Was that girl really dead? Or was she just asleep? Why did Jesus say that she was asleep? In those days, in that part of the world, that was a common thing to say. It was sort of a nice way of talking about something sometimes too difficult to speak of. We do that today. We say that someone that we knew or someone we loved passed away because we don't want to say the words. We don't want to say that she died, that he died. In fact, it was so common among the Greeks and the culture of the Mediterranean world that they had a word. One of the words for sleep is koimeterion. From it, we get our word cemetery. So our word cemetery comes from the Greeks, and a cemetery is a place where people sleep. Of course, we know that it's meant by that, that they're dead. Except in Matthew 9:24, that's not the word that's used. It's a different word for sleep, a word that is seldom ever translated to mean death. Could it be that in fact this girl was really in a deep coma? That she in fact was not actually dead? And that Jesus, his miracle was that he roused her from the coma and saved her from being buried alive. Cataleptic coma was not uncommon in those days. In fact, this is a rather terrible thought, not to be thought when you're going to sleep at night, that there is archaeological evidence that in those days when people typically were buried the same day in which they died, that a number of people were actually buried alive and awakened from their comas, only to try to scratch and struggle to get out of the graves where they died a far more terrible death than anyone could have imagined. If that's the case, it might be said that Jesus saved her from a very different tragedy. Well, let there be no doubt that Jesus, if she were dead, could have raised her from the dead. Because the record is clear and the record is plenty that Jesus on other occasions did do that. Whether Lazarus or others, Jesus was in the business of raising the dead back to life again. It was the ultimate demonstration of the power of God. But in this case, I suppose you can read the record either way. But even in that, I find yet another lesson, even in the ambiguity. It is the lesson that Jesus gives compassionate care, not always in the way we would expect it. Not always in things that we understand, because sometimes, let's be frank about it, we often don't understand what is happening in our own lives, in the lives of our children, in our family. We can't figure it out. It is beyond our comprehension. But he understands. He's always compassionate. And he always cares. The Time magazine article on Dan Quayle and Murphy Brown has a telling line near the end. It's a sentence. It says, "Fatherhood may take moments, motherhood 9 months, but doing it right takes the lifelong commitment of both parents." That's correct. Doing it right does take a commitment, but not just to a daughter or to a son, and not just in difficult moments of desperation. It takes a lifelong commitment to Jesus Christ, he who is compassionate and caring. Just a final word this morning to fathers on Father's Day. I won't ask you to come and to kneel or to lie on the platform or the carpet. But would you be willing to humble yourself inside? Would you, in a sense, be willing on the inside to lie prostrate before Jesus Christ and to plead and to commit on behalf of your children? Let's just bow our heads. And dads, tell Jesus what you're desperate about. Tell him that you believe that he can do what no one else can do. Ask him to come home with you. Ask him for the best for your children. In other words, you too, be a father of faith.
I grew up on a farm in southern Minnesota. I was number 4 in a family of 9 children. Every Sunday, we would all pile into the family station wagon and make the 10-mile drive into church. I am thankful that my parents taught me to go to church, and I learned at an early age to love God, and I felt that he loved me too. But it was a long time later that the opportunity to know him personally through his son, Jesus Christ, was presented to me. I had finished college, gotten married, and had my first baby. After a 6-month leave of absence from work, I sought childcare for my daughter. I obtained a list from the Hennepin County Daycare Association and interviewed several women by phone. I went to visit the most likely candidate and made the necessary arrangements for my daughter. I became friends with this woman and her family. They shared their love for Jesus Christ with me. And after a while, I asked them, "What do I have to do to become a Christian?" That was 10 years ago. On June 21st, 1992, I sat with this family around their kitchen table and poured out my heart to the Lord. I confessed my sins and asked Jesus Christ to come into my heart. I recall the feelings. There was excitement. There was joy. I wanted to tell someone, but whom? I remembered overhearing one of my coworkers say that she was a Christian, so the next morning I rushed into her office and told her the good news. As a new Christian, I experienced a definite discernment of right and wrong, and I had a desire to read the Bible that I didn't have before. Now, a decade later, I reflect on this life-changing experience, not an unusual thing to do on a major birthday or anniversary. I see that the first few years, my enthusiasm was strong, but my knowledge was weak. I had no wisdom. I made bad decisions. I was letting my personal problems direct my life instead of trusting in Jesus Christ. When Wooddale Church moved to this location in Eden Prairie, I started attending services here. My husband and I were receiving counseling from one of the pastors who surprised me one day with the question, "What are you doing about your personal and spiritual growth?" I stumbled for an answer, but other than attending church and listening to Christian radio, not much. A few days later, my neighbor invited me to the introduction class of a Bible study that she was attending. I joined that Bible study because I knew right away that it was where God wanted me to be. My mind was opened to what my heart knew was true. This fall, I will be entering my 5th year of the study of God's Word. I know that the Lord is working in my life, changing me even more in levels of awareness and convictions. The daily discipline of studying God's Word has taught me the importance of obedience to Him, the necessity of prayer, and the enormous love and mercy that God has for me. The Lord told His disciples, "If you love me, you'll keep my word." I do love the Lord, and I want to please him and glorify him. I want to be ready to tell someone else about the Lord, just like my friends told me. I pray that the Lord would give me the boldness and the wisdom to know just what to say, to work on behalf of the Holy Spirit and be an agent of change in another person's life, that they also would experience the love and the strength that God has for us when we follow him.